Buffett introduced Fred Stanback and Rosenfield to the idea of investing in the Washington Monthly, warning them that it was unlikely to be a financial table pounder. But the scandals it might uncover, the ideas it could promote, the minds it could awaken, the exposés it could expose. They put in a little money. In short order, the Washington Monthly ran through its initial capital stake. Buffett held out the possibility of another $50,000. Then he and Peters had a 50-minute phone conversation. And, oh God, says Peters, as an investment, it reeked of the potential for failure. There was his instinct as a hard businessman and his philanthropic good citizen instinct on the other side, and they were clearly at war. He was worried about his business reputation and would come within an inch of pulling out, and I would slowly try to pull him back. Warren kept finding new plausible escape routes, and I tried to block the exits. But the glorious thing was, he ended up staying in. Buffett added the condition that the editors had to put in some of their own money while Peters raised some outside, which Buffett said he would match 80%. Peters was a better journalist than an accountant. They raised the money, the checks went out, then nobody heard from the Washington Monthly for months. They just vanished, says Buffett. Fred Stanback complained that he was getting IRS forms late and had to amend his tax returns. Although the Washington Monthly was indeed putting out strong stories, as Buffett had wanted, it wasn't enough. He had known from the beginning that it would not make money, but he thought it ought to be accountable for the money that it had. He was embarrassed at having drawn Stanback and Rosenfield into a bear hunt. The investors felt they were being treated like bank tellers. Buffett wanted to be a partner in journalism, a fellow news hound, not just the guy who bankrolled idealism. Yet even with mixed results, Buffett was now pursuing the personal concerns of which he had spoken in his October 1967 letter to his partners. Meanwhile, the market continued to dry up and deprive him of opportunities. Spending part of his time as a publishing magnate was no help in adjusting to that reality. Whatever else occupied him, he remained wholly committed to the partnership, too, and it turned out that a less compulsive approach to investing was not in his nature. So he started to figure out the best way to wind down the partnership. He says he received offers from a couple of people to buy the management firm, which would have meant the opportunity to sell at a large profit, but he thought this was not right. It was unusual for a money manager to forego a large sum of money, even in those days, and so far, Buffett had shown no inclination to avoid getting richer. But he had always stayed on the same side as his partners, harnessing his avarice to their benefit as well as his own. Around Memorial Day, 1969, Buffett wrote the partners to tell them that simply lowering his goal hadn't lessened his intensity. If I am going to participate publicly, I can't help being competitive. I know I don't want to be totally occupied with outpacing an investment rabbit all my life. The only way to slow down is to stop. And then he delivered his bombshell. He announced he would be giving his formal notice of retirement by year-end and closing down the partnership in early 1970. I am not attuned to this market environment, and I don't want to spoil a decent record by trying to play a game I don't understand just so I can go out a hero. What would he do now? I don't have an answer to that question, he wrote. I do know that when I am 60, I should be attempting to achieve different personal goals than those which had priority at age 20. The partners howled with disappointment, and a few with fear. Many were naifs, like his Aunt Alice. They were ministers, rabbis, schoolteachers, grandmothers, and mothers-in-law. His announcement amounted to a market call on stocks. He did not think the game would be worth playing any time soon. He had taught even the inexperienced to be wary of an overheated market. Some trusted no one other than him. But he just didn't want to operate in an environment where he didn't feel comfortable with the opportunities, says John Harding, especially when it was something that he felt he had to devote all his time to. Susie Buffett was happy that Warren was shutting down the partnership, at least for the kids' sake. They cared desperately what their father thought of them. Susie Jr. had always gotten most of what little attention Warren provided, and Peter felt rewarded for being quiet and staying in the background. But 14-year-old Howie, who had always sought some emotional connection to his father that was never forthcoming, had grown wilder as he grew up. Susie Jr. would find a pair of mannequin legs covered with fake blood sticking out of her closet. He climbed on the roof in the gorilla costume to spy on her when she came home from dates, and drenched her with the sprayer from the kitchen sink when she appeared in her prom dress. When their parents were in New York City, Howie seized the chance for an experiment in anarchy. Warren, still relying on Susie for everything, assumed she would take care of whatever Howie and the other kids needed. But by now, Susie herself had stopped trying to control her children, and she had long since let go of any idealistic expectations regarding her marriage. Her attention was increasingly taken up by an expanding number of vagrants, as one friend put it, who wandered through the house, sought her help, and occupied her time. Since she almost always accepted people unconditionally, some of those clients had pasts as felons, con men, addicts, or in one case, as the purported proprietor of a bawdy house. From time to time, these people conned her out of money. She didn't really mind. Buffett was infuriated at the thought of being cheated himself, but he had eventually come to think of this as part of Susie's giveaway budget, and even accepted it as part of her charm. Her large group of women friends continued to expand. Bella Eisenberg, Eunice Denenberg, Jeannie Lipsey, Racky Newman, and others. Though Warren recognized who most of them were, this was Susie's circle, not his. Other ties of hers, people like Rodney and Angie Weed, came from the activist community. Another set of friends centered around the tennis courts at Dewey Park. And there was always the family. Lila, especially now that Roy Ralph had died and she had taken back the Buffett name, Fred and Katie Buffett and their son Fritz, who had married Warren and Susie's former babysitter, Pam, also, of course, a friend of Susie's now. Her nephews Tom and Billy Rogers were often around, as was another guitarist from the local music scene whom she had met through Billy, David Stryker. Like the Rogers boys and Dave Stryker, a number of Susie's friends were younger. She was close to Renee and Annette Gibson, daughters of the baseball player Bob Gibson and his wife Charlene. Several of the black students to whom she had given scholarships had come under her wing and wandered in from time to time. Russell McGregor, Pat Turner, and Dwayne Taylor, son of the jazz great Billy Taylor. And so it went. Even though Susie was the fountainhead of all this generosity, she was starting to need a little attention, too. It wouldn't have taken much, according to her friends, just an ounce of effort on her husband's part. She disagreed that making money was life's purpose. She felt impoverished denying herself travel, museums, theater, art, and most other forms of culture because of his lack of interest. Warren praised her effusively in public, but when at home or work, lapsed into his normal preoccupied state. If he would make an effort by going to an art gallery with her now and then, or take her on a trip just because she wanted to go, it would make a difference, she said. But while he did sometimes show up when asked, if she had to ask, it was a favor, not a gift. Now that Susie realized that Warren was never going to take off to Italy for weeks on end, she began to travel on her own or with her women friends, sometimes to visit family, such as Bertie, who now lived in California, and sometimes to attend personal growth seminars. One day at the Chicago airport, a man stopped in front of her as she sat on a bench. "Are you Susie Thompson?" he asked. She looked up, embarrassed to have been caught with a mouthful of hot dog. It was Milt Brown, her high school sweetheart, whom she had not seen in years. He sat down and they began to get reacquainted. Susie, who was always reaching out for emotional connections, would later say that her husband wasn't lacking in emotion, he was just cut off from his own feelings. And it certainly seemed as though his strongest emotional bonds were with his friends and partners, to whom he felt an intense obligation, and with whom he had created a de facto family. The other Buffetts could not help but notice the way he lit up in their company, in contrast to the dutiful but preoccupied manner he displayed while attending his own family events. Thus, even now that he was preparing to close the partnership that had consumed most of his waking hours for the last 13 years, he remained fully engaged with his partners and seemed a little reluctant to let go of his connection to them. He went to extremes to help them place their money in good hands, writing them another letter describing their options in meticulous detail. Explaining his dedication to them, he says, "The question of finding other advisors is a tough one. When I wound up my partnership, I had these partners that had counted on me, and I was going to be distributing a lot of money. I felt an obligation to at least suggest some alternatives for them." This was unusual behavior for a money manager, to say the least. Even Ben Graham had only said, "Oh, buy AT&T," when asked, and mentioned Buffett offhandedly to a few people. But Buffett made elaborate efforts to shepherd his partners on to their future investing life. Some of them were already in the Munger partnership, and Buffett sent one or two more to him. But Munger was queasy about the market. "Who wants to be around people when you're disappointing them?" he says, "particularly when you sucked them into the relationship." He also lacked Buffett's genius for promotion. "I recommended two people to the partners whom I knew were exceptionally good and exceptionally honest, Sandy Gottesman and Bill Ruane. I'd been around the investment world for a long time at that point, and I'd gotten to know them over the years. So I not only knew their results, but I knew how they'd accomplished their results, which was terribly important." So the richer partners would go to Gottesman at First Manhattan. But Sandy didn't want the small fry, so Buffett sent the rest to Ruane, who was now leaving Kidder Peabody, to set up his own investment advisory firm, Ruane, Cunniff, and Stiers, with two partners, Rick Cunniff and Sidney Stiers, and creating the Sequoia Fund specifically to take on the smaller accounts. They hired John Harding, who would be out of a job when the partnership dissolved, to run an Omaha office for the new company. John Loomis, the securities salesman who was Carol Loomis's husband, and Buffett's trusty researcher Henry Brandt also went to Ruane Cunniff, giving it, in effect, a full staff. These connections also kept Harding, Loomis, and Brandt in Buffett's extended family. Buffett brought Ruane to Omaha and promoted the Sequoia Fund to the partners. He endorsed Ruane in typically mathematical terms. Unremarkably, even though he had known Ruane for years, he still felt it necessary to leave a small escape hatch, fearing blame in case things didn't work out, and wrote, "There is no way to eliminate the possibility of error when judging humans, but I consider Bill to be an exceptionally high probability decision on character and a high probability one on investment performance." Yet while Buffett made arrangements to close the partnership, the first signs appeared that the market sparks were going to cool. By July 1969, when U.S. troops began withdrawing from Vietnam, the Dow had dropped 19%. Even though the triumphant moon landing that summer gave the country a lift, Wall Street did not feel it. Exotic stocks like National Student Marketing and Minnie Pearl's Chicken System Incorporated, which had garnered a huge following in the market where half the money managers and brokers had been working in the business for no more than 7 years, were starting to collapse. Blue chip stamps, the trading stamp stock painstakingly accumulated by Buffett, Munger, and Guerin, now became a striking exception to the general trend. The three of them had been betting on whether the company could settle its antitrust lawsuit with Sperry and Hutchinson. When a settlement was reached, this stock, which the Buffett partners didn't know they owned, showered nearly $7 million in profit on them in return for a $2 million investment less than a year ago. Now Blue Chip decided to have a public offering, and Buffett elected to sell the partnership shares as part of that deal. It seemed that the partners were going to have a splendid final year in 1969. That October, Buffett called another meeting of the Grahamites, including those who had gathered in San Diego the year before, sans Ben Graham himself. This time, the wives were also invited, and although they did not join the meetings in which the men talked about stocks, their presence made the atmosphere more festive, like a vacation. Buffett delegated the planning to Marshall Weinberg, who lived in New York City and liked to travel. But Weinberg, who also liked to shave a dime and had no more experience of the jet-set life than Buffett, asked around and then made the unfortunate choice of the Colony Club, a Palm Beach, Florida resort where they were treated like rubes and snooted at even by the bellboys. Ruane reported at the first night's dinner that the bellhop had handed him back his $5 tip with a sneer, saying, "You need it more than I do." Bill Scott had given his bellhop a handful of the dimes he always carried in his pocket to make phone calls for Buffett. The bellhop threw the change all over the floor in the hallway on his way out. For the next 5 days, as the group enjoyed bad food, small rooms, high winds, and lashing rains, the men sat classroom style, with Buffett most often in his usual place at the front. They batted thoughts back and forth in an encoded shorthand derived from many years of conversation and a closely shared set of concepts and values. "Charlie told some horror stories," Buffett wrote later, "and I drew the same gloomy conclusions. While Walter Schloss said that two mislocated steel companies with obsolete plants were still below book value, so all was not lost. Buffett posed the desert island challenge. If you were stranded on a desert island for 10 years, he asked, in what stock would you invest? The trick was to find a company with the strongest franchise, one least subject to the corroding forces of competition and time, Munger's idea of the great business. As Henry Brandt took copious notes on the various answers, Buffett delivered his own choice, Dow Jones, owner of the Wall Street Journal. His interest in newspapers was growing and would only become more intense, yet curiously, he did not actually own this stock. The gathering ended much as it had begun, with more displays of rudeness from the hotel staff, who had no idea they were hosting anything other than a third-rate group of stockbrokers at a time when the market was falling. The staff had officiously shooed the Grahamites away from the jewelry cases on the hotel mezzanine. On the last day, as the group was departing, Ed Anderson approached the front desk and asked how best to get to the airport. Most of our guests go by limousine, he was told, but for you folks, we'll call a cab. Buffett would go on to describe the Colony Club as a friendly family hotel, that is, friendly if you were the Kennedy family. It was a low-class performance by a high-class place, says Anderson. Later, when a Fort Lauderdale businessman who held the mortgage on the Colony Club asked Buffett to advise him on a financing deal, Buffett told the man he would be happy to do it without taking a fee, but if you ever have the chance to foreclose on them, do it. One of those Buffett had invited to the Colony Club was Hochschild Cohn's Lewis Cohn. Buffett had grown fond of Cohn and his wife, and he and Susie had vacationed with them in Cozumel. But inviting them to the Colony Club gathering proved awkward, since no sooner had the meeting been planned than Buffett and Munger started to realize that Hochschild Cohn was not going to work out for them. Retail is a very tough business, says Charlie Munger. We realized that we were wrong. Practically every great chain store operation that has been around long enough eventually gets in trouble and is hard to fix. The dominant retailer in one 20-year period is not necessarily the dominant retailer in the next. Their experience had given them a deep wariness of retailing, one that would only grow, not lessen, over time. They wanted businesses that would marmalade them with money, businesses that had some sort of sustainable competitive advantage and could outwit the natural cycle of capital creation and destruction as long as possible. Not long after the meeting in Florida, Munger and Buffett sold Hochschild Cohn to Supermarkets General for about what it had cost them. Buffett wanted to act fast in order to unload the company before winding down the partnership and distributing the assets, and along with the company, the Cohns disappeared from the Buffetts' lives. Diversified Retailing had issued unsecured debt, debentures, to finance the Hochschild Cohn purchase. Buffett had taken special care with this, his first public financing, and insisted to his underwriters that the bonds have several unusual features. The bankers had objected that a novel structure would make the bond harder to sell. I said, "Well, but bonds should have this in there." That was the first bond issue I ever sold, and I put a few things in there that the underwriters had no interest in whatsoever. But I had thought a lot about bond issues over the years, and I had thought about how bondholders got taken. Bondholders historically earned less than stockholders because they gave up the potentially unlimited opportunity of a shareholder in favor of lower risk. But Buffett knew that in the real world, this was not necessarily true. One of the things I put in was that if we didn't pay the interest on the bond for any reason, the bondholders took over voting control of the company, so they didn't have to get Mickey-moused by bankruptcy and all that kind of stuff. Ben Graham had written about this in Security Analysis with as much passion as he mustered on any subject, describing how courts rarely allow bondholders to seize the assets that back those bonds unless the assets are nearly worthless. Unsecured bondholders' interests were worked over in receivership through a strangling process that delayed payment almost to the point of irrelevance. Thus, DRC's debenture also provided that the company could not pay dividends while the debentures were outstanding, meaning that equity investors could not siphon off profits while interest on the bonds was in arrears. The second unusual provision was that the debentures paid 8%, but, depending on the earnings of the company, could pay up to an additional 1%. And Buffett added a third provision. Because he felt that the bonds would be sold mainly to people who knew him or his reputation, He wanted the bonds to be redeemable if he sold enough stock in DRC that he was no longer the largest shareholder. And nobody had ever stuck anything like this in a covenant. I said, "You know, they're entitled to have this in there. They may not want to redeem them, but they're entitled if they want to. They lent money to me, basically." When his own banker, Nelson Wilder, protested that such clauses were unprecedented and unnecessary, Buffett overruled him. Now that interest rates had risen and banks were newly reluctant to lend, the debentures suddenly became a valuable form of cheap financing, a powerful consolation prize. Nevertheless, since Buffett thought of a dollar today as the $50 or $100 that it could become someday, it was as if he had lost many millions on Hochschild Cohn because of the foregone opportunity to use the money more effectively. He drew a conclusion that he would later state as, "Time is the friend of the wonderful business, the enemy of the mediocre." You might think this principle is obvious, but I had to learn it the hard way. After ending our corporate marriage to Hochschild Cohn, I had memories like those of the husband in the country song, "My wife ran away with my best friend, and I still miss him a lot." It's far better to buy a wonderful company at a fair price than a fair company at a wonderful price. Charlie understood this early. I was a slow learner. But now, when buying companies or common stocks, we look for first-class businesses accompanied by first-class managements. That leads right into a related lesson. Good jockeys will do well on good horses, but not on broken-down nags. Even as Buffett and Munger were working on the sale of Hochschild Cohn in the fall of 1969, Forbes hit the newsstand with a story about Buffett titled, "How Omaha Beats Wall Street." The article opened in such an arresting manner that other writers covering Buffett would copy it for decades afterward. $10,000 invested in his Buffett partnership in 1957, Forbes said, is now worth $260,000. The partnership, which now had assets of $100 million, had grown at an annual compounded rate of 31%. Over that 12-year period, it hasn't had 1 year in which it lost money. Buffett has accomplished this through following consistently fundamental investing principles. The anonymous columnist for Forbes then wrote one of the more insightful statements ever made about Buffett. "Buffett is not a simple person, but he has simple tastes." This not-simple Buffett with simple tastes had insisted on total secrecy in his stock dealings when he ran his partnership and was never once profiled in an interview. Now, however, when secrecy was no longer important, he had cooperated with a high-profile article about himself. The article did not print or even whisper his net worth. The reporter did not know that since Buffett closed the partnership to new partners in 1966, his fees, reinvested, had quadrupled his net worth to $26.5 million in just 3 years. Nor that, with no money coming in from new partners to dilute him, his share of the partnership's assets had risen from 19% to 26%. The story cited his rambling old Omaha house and the lack of computers and vast staff in his unimpressive office. True, the man with simple tastes still chugged 4 or 5 bottles of Pepsi a day, asked for it instead of wine at dinner parties, and ate only the dinner rolls if anything more complicated than a steak or hamburger was served. A helpless captive of whoever happened to be doing the laundry at home, he still sometimes turned up in public looking little better than a hobo and barely noticed the condition of his clothes. He would have been happy in a 2-room garage apartment. The money was just his scorecard. It was Susie who cared about living well, and it was she who thought that money was pointless unless used for some purpose. Nonetheless, the Buffetts had for some time lived the life of a well-to-do couple, though not, of course, a life as luxurious as they could have afforded. Susie had even upgraded Warren to a Cadillac like her own, but only the most stripped-down version with no extra features, and after she had called every dealer within miles to get the cheapest deal. People found the contrast between his homespun tastes and his ever-growing fortune refreshing. His genial manner, self-deprecating wit, and air of calm put them at ease. He had shed some of his earlier gracelessness and most of his arrogance, along with the more obvious signs of insecurity, though his tolerance for criticism had not increased. He was learning to hide his impatience. He showed great loyalty to longtime friends. People were especially struck by his fundamental honesty. Those who spent long periods in his presence, however, found the unleashed whirlwind of his energy exhausting. "Insatiable," they whispered, and sometimes felt a guilty relief when his attention lapsed. He inhaled information and was prone to deluging his friends with mountains of clippings and reading material that he thought would interest them, before realizing with a start that they had fallen months behind his pace. His conversations were less casual than they seemed. They always seemed to have a purpose, however obscure it might be to those on the receiving end. People sometimes realized he was somehow testing them. Buffett vibrated with an inner tension that belied his outwardly casual style. It was hard to imagine what he was going to do with all that energy and intensity without the partnership. Many of the partners found it hard to imagine what they were going to do without him. Many of them had become his train bearers and were reluctant to let go. Their reluctance struck an ironic note next to the fate of the other Buffett family business. Concurrent with its centennial, Fred Buffett threw his hands in the air and gave up on the Buffett grocery store. Neither of his sons wanted to take over, and even though it had $500,000 a year in sales, when he tried to find a buyer, there were no takers. The grinding wheel of capitalism had spoken. The Buffetts were not socialites and had never thrown a really large party. But with both the store and the partnership closing, they celebrated with a bash one night during the last weekend of September 1969. Nearly 200 people of all ages and races poured into their house. Businessmen, society matrons, poor adopted clients of Susie's, teenagers, friends who were now rich from the partnership, Susie's women pals, assorted priests, rabbis, and ministers, and local politicians made their way through a string of flashing lights past the 3-foot Pepsi bottles in the windows. Susie had chosen a New York theme, stage door deli food and decor, and told people to dress in casual kosher. They showed up in everything from culottes to cocktail dresses. A half-cut beer barrel burst with chrysanthemums in her favorite color, sunshine yellow. A table was set up like a deli cart, covered with pastrami sandwiches and cheeses, and hung with sausages and a real plucked chicken, in keeping with the theme. A piano player next to the beer keg in the sunroom encouraged guests to sing along. The aroma from a popcorn machine outside the racquetball court welcomed guests into an impromptu basement movie theater. The court ceiling bobbed with giant helium balloons. Films with W.C. Fields, Mae West, and Laurel and Hardy ran all evening long. In the solarium, the elderly Fred Buffett protected two bikini-clad models as the guests covered them with body paint. "I had such a good time that I hate to think it's over," Susie said afterward. Part 4. Susie Sings. Chapter 34. Candy Harry. Omaha, 1970 to the spring of 1972. 2 months after the stage door deli party, as Buffett took the formal steps to unwind the partnership, the Dow broke 800 on the downside. A month later, in January 1970, his friend Carol Loomis highlighted his spectacular performance over the course of the partnership's history and his dour view of the prospects for stocks in an article on hedge funds in Fortune. Shortly before the article appeared, as the market started to snowplow downhill, he sent the partners a letter explaining what they owned. Berkshire Hathaway, which he said was worth about $45 per share. Of this, about $16 was tied up in textiles, a business that he said was not satisfactory and had an even smaller chance of being so in the future. But even though that was one-third of the value, he would not liquidate it to free the cash. "I like the textile operating people," he wrote. "They have worked hard to improve the business under difficult conditions, and, despite the poor return, we expect to continue the textile operation as long as it produces near current levels." Berkshire Hathaway also owned the much more profitable insurer, National Indemnity. Diversified Retailing, which he valued at $11.50 to $12 per share. DRC consisted of only the scroungy associated cotton shops and cash and notes from the sale of Hochschild Cone, which he planned to use for reinvestment in other operating businesses. He did not specify what these might be, implicitly requiring the departing partners to trust his judgment, just as they had when they joined the partnership. Blue chip stamps, revealed for the first time. Buffett told the partners he would probably cash them out of this investment because the company was planning a sale of stock around the end of the year. Illinois National Bank and Trust Company of Rockford, Illinois, also owned by Berkshire Hathaway. Sun Newspapers, which he described as not financially significant. The departing partners were floored to find that through their ownership of Berkshire Hathaway, they owned a trading stamp company, a bank, and an insignificant newspaper. Now they had to decide whether to hold these cards or trade them, because they could have all cash instead. "He would cut the pie, and you would be able to get the first choice on the pieces," says John Harding. This was a brilliant move on Buffett's part. He, of course, wanted them to choose the cash, leaving the Berkshire Hathaway and diversified retailing stocks for himself. Nevertheless, he was honest with them. In a letter of October 9, 1969, he made a market forecast, which he had previously declined to do. "With the market at such heights, for the first time in my professional life," he wrote, "I now believe there is little choice for the average investor between professionally managed money in stocks and passive investment in bonds." Although he did allow as how the very best money managers might be able to squeeze out a few percentage points over the earnings of bonds, nonetheless, the departing partners shouldn't have high hopes for what they could do with the cash. 2 months later, on December 5th, he gave a prediction about how these two stocks would do, along with telling the partners what he was going to do himself. "My personal opinion is that the intrinsic value of DRC and BH will grow substantially over the years. I would be disappointed if such growth wasn't at a rate of approximately 10% per annum." That was an important statement. He was telling them that Berkshire and Diversified would not only do better than bonds, but better than he had said in October the partners could expect from even the very best money managers. "I think both securities should be very decent long-term holdings, and I am happy to have a substantial portion of my net worth invested in them. I think there is a very high probability that I will maintain my investment in DRC and BH for a very long period." Separately, Buffett wrote the partners a dissertation on how to invest in bonds, again extending himself considerably more than a typical money manager would ever do. "Even so, I had four people panic when I closed down. All four were divorced women. They trusted me, and they didn't trust anybody else. They had had bad experiences with men, and they didn't feel they could make it again if they lost what money they'd gotten. They would call me in the middle of the night and say, 'You've got to keep earning me money,' and all this sort of thing." But he refused to act as what he considered to be a fiduciary if he could not perform to his high standards. "Basically, if I'm the guarantor, I just can't do it, knowing how hard it was on me once," he says, hearkening back to what he had felt at age 11 when City's Service Preferred had disappointed his sister. He continued working on the partnership dissolution over Christmas in Laguna Beach. He had bought his Christmas gifts with his usual efficiency. As with most things, he had a system. He went to Tops, the best dress shop in Omaha, and gave them a list of the different sizes for all the women in his life. "I would go over, and they'd wheel out the dresses. I'd make a variety of decisions and buy presents for my sisters, Susie, Gladys, and so forth. I kind of enjoyed it. Bertie's more conservative, so I'd move her up a notch in style, and she'd accept it from me, but nobody else. You know, clothing holds its value better than jewelry." On December 26th, after the exchange of Christmas gifts, he sent the partners another long letter, going out of his way to answer at length a number of their questions. A few of the partners had been challenging him. They were deciding whether to hold the Berkshire stock. If it was such a lousy business, why not get rid of the Berkshire Hathaway textile mill? "I have no desire to trade severe human dislocations for a few percentage points additional return per annum," he wrote, echoing what he had said to them in his letter of January 1969. But since the whole point of his business was to eke out a few additional percentage points per annum, this kind of rationalization would have been unthinkable earlier in his career. "What is Sun Newspapers?" they asked. "It's worth a buck a share," he replied, kind of skipping the rest of the economics. Then he added some famous last words. "We have no particular plans to expand in the communication field," he wrote. Why didn't you register the Berkshire Hathaway in diversified stock so that it could be freely traded? Berkshire was so closely held that it traded by appointment, which made it hard for anyone to know what the stock was actually worth. Diversified did not trade at all. A long, complicated explanation followed, in which Buffett argued that a freely traded and liquid public market for these stocks would be less efficient and less fair, and the more sophisticated partners might have an important edge over the less sophisticated partners. And it was certainly true that the more naive of his departing partners would be kept from the clutches of the manic-depressive Mr. Market, who might at times have valued the stock at a severely discounted price. It lowered the odds that a pack of brokers would talk them into selling just to buy IBM or AT&T. But it also meant that Buffett was limiting his partners' options, making it harder for them to buy and harder for them to sell. And, if they did sell, making it more likely that they would sell to him. As general partner of the partnership, he was used to having total control of these two companies. Letting go and giving up control to the anonymous Mr. Market, he just couldn't do it. Moreover, as soon as he handed these stocks to his departing partners, for the first time his own self-interest and theirs might be at odds. This complicated rationale to justify keeping the stocks unregistered danced a little do-si-do around the fact that Buffett was the most sophisticated partner of all. It was he who would have the most important edge over his former partners. No matter how honest his intentions, the decision widened the potential conflict between his interests and theirs. The painfully earnest tone of Buffett's letter sounds like someone who has had to talk himself into thinking that he is doing the right thing. But the conflict was guaranteed to cause hard feelings. Anyone who sold to him and was later sorry could look back with hindsight and think, "He had an edge on me." Still, the Howard in Warren demanded that he present their options with scrupulous honesty. The way he answered the next question told the departing partners exactly what to expect. "Should I hold my stock?" they asked. Buffett gave as clear and direct advice as he would ever give in public about a stock. "All I can say is that I'm going to do so," he said, "and I plan to buy more." The departing partners were also going to have a third stock to deal with. In this same letter of December 26th, Buffett told them that the blue chip stock sale had fallen through. The stock had plunged in a short time from a high of $25 to $13 a share because Safeway stores had dropped blue chip stamps, its customer base was eroding, and no buyer was in sight for the one-third of the business that the Justice Department had mandated it sell. Two new lawsuits had been filed against it in the U.S. District Court in Los Angeles, one by Douglas Oil Company and the other by a group of filling stations, who said Blue Chip had broken the antitrust laws, that it was a monopoly, and asked for treble damages and attorney's fees. Yet even as Blue Chip's problems multiplied and the price fell, Buffett had been buying the stock instead of selling. He had bought it for diversified retailing and for national indemnity. He had bought it for Cornhusker Casualty and National Fire and Marine, two little insurance companies that Berkshire had acquired. He had also bought it for himself and for Susie. Now the partners knew that Buffett wouldn't sell, and indeed planned to hoover up more of all these stocks. They would get whichever they wanted, stock or cash. If they took the money, he would get the stock. If they kept their stock, they would still be his partners, in a sense. In his anxiety over whether people accepted and liked him, Buffett valued loyalty more than almost anything. He looked for loyalty in all of his relationships. The dissolution of the partnership had elements of a loyalty test, as his behavior afterward would make clear. When the partnership unwound, Buffett had more money to buy even more stock. For even while holding on to his shares, he personally owned 18% of Berkshire Hathaway, 20% of Diversified, and 2% of Blue Chip Stamps, he and Susie had hauled home roughly $16 million in cash by the end of 1969. During the ensuing year, the shares of Berkshire and Diversified quickly began to change hands, as though a giant were shuffling a deck of cards. As he had promised, but on a scale that might have staggered his partners had they known, Buffett used the cash he got from the partnership to buy still more Berkshire and Diversified for his own account. He used Berkshire's cash to buy its own stock, and for DRC, offered to buy the company stock from some people in exchange for a DRC note that paid interest at 9%. He bought from people ranging from his former brother-in-law Truman Wood to his first investor, Homer Dodge, and his son Norton. Those who rejected these offers had to be willing to ride along and let Buffett reinvest the earnings without ever paying out a dime, a show of trust that was important to him. Forever after, he would feel a loyalty to those who kept the stock, a loyalty of such depth and strength that the Standard Model modern CEO would find it completely incomprehensible. Berkshire, he would later reflect, is still like a partnership. You basically have the closest thing to a private business with shareholders who identify with you and who like to come to Omaha. He thought of partners as people who had come together out of a complex set of shared values and interests, not out of short-term economic convenience. He often said that he tried to treat his partners the way he would treat his family. His partners were people who trusted him, people to whom he owed a special duty. In return, he expected loyalty from them. Yet people made their decisions for all sorts of reasons. Some needed money. Others simply invested in the Sequoia Fund after listening to Bill Ruane. Many people's brokers urged them to sell the stock of a money-gobbling textile mill. Some listened, some didn't. Some professional investors had other options and thought they were better off without these humdrum stocks. When Warren went to the West Coast in person and offered the DRC note, Estee Graham's sister Betty sold her stock. Estee didn't. Rhoda Sarnett, Ben Graham's cousin, and her husband Bernie decided not to sell, telling themselves, Warren's buying, and if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for us. When he offered the note to his sister Doris, she refused it, thinking, if he's buying, why would I sell? A few partners quizzed Buffett more closely in person for his opinion of how the stocks would do. He said, carefully, that he thought they would do well, but it could take a long time. People like Jack Alexander and Marshall Weinberg parsed those words, considered the fact that they were good investors themselves, and sold him part of their stock. Munger would later call Buffett an implacable acquirer, like John D. Rockefeller in the early days of assembling his empire, who let nobody and nothing get in his way. With hindsight, some people felt hard done by, enticed, or even misled. Others said to themselves, in effect, well, that's just Warren. I should have known. By the end of 1970, many of the former partners had cashed out while Warren continued buying more stock. His and Susie's ownership of Berkshire had shot from 18% to almost 36%. Their ownership of DRC had nearly doubled to 39%. As a practical matter, Buffett now controlled both. He had also bought more blue chip, taking him from 2% to over 13% ownership of its stock. But it was clear to Susie Buffett that Warren's gyrations to get control of Diversified and Berkshire Hathaway meant that her husband's second retirement would be similar to his first. One reason was that Blue Chip was in the same sort of trouble as Berkshire Hathaway. The business was no longer just shrinking, it was dying, so he and Munger would have to buy something new to springboard its capital. In late 1971, after President Nixon abandoned the gold standard, the price of oil skyrocketed, and half the country's oil companies suddenly stopped issuing trading stamps. With prices of everything leapfrogging day by day because of inflation, the classic retailing method of enticing customers into a store through a panoply of services and giveaways was thrown overboard. People wanted the lowest price, and retailers headed to a discount model. Any chance that housewives would plan their shopping to collect enough books of trading stamps to get an electric frying pan evaporated. Then one day, Buffett got a call from Bill Ramsey, Blue Chip's president, saying that a local Los Angeles company, See's Candies, was for sale. Buffett had carved out a tiny subspecialty of studying candy companies, keeping a file on Fanny Farmer, and looking into the company that made Necco wafers. But candy companies were expensive. So far, he had never bitten. Call Charlie, he said. Munger was in charge of Blue Chip, their West Coast business. See's, founded in 1921 by a Canadian candy salesman, competed by using the finest quality butter, cream, chocolate, fruits, and nuts, painstakingly prepared to See's quality, which was better than top quality. During World War II, rather than dilute its recipes to stretch rationed ingredients, See's had put signs in its distinctive black and white stores, "Sold out. Buy war bonds for Christmas." The company became a California institution. "See's has a name that nobody can get near in California," Munger told him. "We can get it at a reasonable price. It's impossible to compete with that brand without spending all kinds of money." Ed Anderson thought it was expensive, but Munger was overflowing with enthusiasm. He and Buffett went through the plant, and Munger said, "What a fantastic business! And the manager, Chuck Huggins? Boy, is he smart, and we can keep him on." See's had a tentative deal on the table already and wanted $30 million for assets worth $5 million. The difference was See's brand, reputation, and trademarks, and most of all, its customer goodwill. Susie Buffett, for example, was crazy about See's, which she had discovered in California. They decided that See's was like a bond, worth paying $25 million for. If the company had paid out its earnings as interest, the interest would average about 9%. That was not enough. Owning a business was riskier than owning a bond, and the interest rate was not guaranteed. But the earnings were growing, on average 12% a year. So See's was like a bond whose interest payments grew. Furthermore, we thought it had uncapped pricing power. See's was selling candy for about the price of Russell Stover at the time, and the big question in my mind was, if you got another 15 cents a pound, that was $2.5 million on top of $4 million of earnings. So you really were buying something that perhaps could earn $6.5 or $7 million at the time, if just priced a little more aggressively. They had to negotiate to buy the company from two people. First, Charles B.C., or Candy Harry, as Buffett, Munger, and Guerin called him, who was managing the estate of his recently deceased older brother, Larry C. The two brothers were partners, but Larry had run the business. Candy Harry really didn't want to run See's. He was interested in wine and girls. He wanted to chase after girls. But of course, he got cold feet about selling at the last minute. Rick and Charlie went to see him, and Charlie gave one of the great lectures of all time on the advantages of grapes and girls, how the highest and best use of Candy Harry's time was chasing after women. The other person involved was Numbers Harry, Harry W. Moore, the company's finance chief and a director. Through its lawyers, Blue Chip set about courting Numbers Harry through the financial advantages of the deal, while suggesting to Candy Harry that a sale would relieve him of potential conflicts of interest that arose from serving as his brother's executor. At the price Blue Chip offered, $25 million, the $4 million it was earning pre-tax would give Buffett and Munger payback of 9% after tax on their investment from the first day they bought it, not factoring in future growth. Adding in the $2 to $3 million of price increases they thought See's could institute, the return on their capital would rise to 14%, a decent level of profitability on an investment, although it wasn't a sure thing. The key was whether the earnings would continue to grow. Buffett and Munger came close to walking. The pickings had been so easy until now, and they had such an ingrained habit of underbidding that it was like swallowing live guppies for them to pay the asking price. "You guys are crazy," Munger's employee Ira Marshall said. "There are some things you should pay up for. Human quality, business quality, and so forth. You're underestimating quality." "Warren and I listened to the criticism," says Munger. "We changed our mind. In the end, they came to the exact dollar limit of what we were willing to pay." While the deal was being struck, Buffett discovered that Tweedy Brown already owned 1,000 shares of See's. Buffett ordered the firm to tender its stock to him. The Tweedy Brown partners knew how valuable See's was and thought the price was too low. They resisted and debated the issue briefly with Buffett. They did not see why they should give him their See's stock. He insisted he needed the stock more than Tweedy Brown did. Buffett won. They gave him the stock. The instant that the deal was inked and the trio of Buffett, Munger, and Guerin joined the board, Buffett threw himself into the candy business with an enthusiasm he had never displayed with companies like Dempster and Berkshire Hathaway, where he had appointed proxies. He sent boxes of See's to his fellow Grahamites. Within days, he wrote a detailed letter to Chuck Huggins, executive vice president, explaining that he had been talking to shopping center owners around the country about opening new See's stores in locations like Colorado Springs, Fayetteville, and Galveston. He suggested that Huggins avoid Iowa because the shopping center executives had told him that Iowans are generally not candy enthusiasts. He gave Huggins permission to stop sending monthly boxes of candy to the long list of women whom Candy Harry had designated as his special friends. He started following sugar futures and cocoa futures, which at 58 cents a pound were approaching prices unheard of since the year of the Rockwood cocoa caper. Buffett suggested experimenting with pre-packaged candy. He wanted to see results, budgets, and lots of financial information. He wrote Huggins about a store in Las Vegas. "It's interesting how many more dollars we can take out of a community when we get the right sort of location. You were doing a first-class job of extending our ring of preeminence." Buffett suggested that Huggins play around with advertising slogans and try to come up with one along the lines of Coca-Cola's Pause That Refreshes or the Rocky Mountain Spring Water of Coors Beer. It was as if, over his breakfast cornflakes, Huggins could dream up an advertising slogan as compelling as Coca-Cola's. One longtime employee described Buffett's Dale Carnegie management style this way: "He'd always praise you while he gave you more to do." As the bar subtly rose an inch or two with each new accomplishment, and the hurdler was reassured that he could surely leap to ever higher heights, the effect was like a tiny stream of water. Its gentle, unrelenting pressure felt wonderful until it finally drove its recipient mad. Thus, when Buffett's attention broke, as it inevitably did, it could seem like a relief. Deceived by the initial gush of enthusiasm, Huggins signed up Buffett for several candy industry trade magazines. Eventually, Buffett, turning his attention to some newer interest, asked for a cease and desist. "Charlie may have visions of becoming a candy maker someday," he wrote, "but I will continue to just read the statements." He had discovered that he liked owning a candy company, not running one. It was much the same at home. Buffett would tell someone with great sincerity, "Please come visit. I really want to see you," then bury his head in a newspaper when they arrived, apparently satisfied with their presence. But there was also the odd chance that he wanted to talk and talk, and they might go away exhausted. Susie had seen his enthusiasms come and go. Warren was still besotted with his wife, praised her constantly in public, and cuddled her on his lap. But at home, as always, he withdrew into his private pursuits and wanted to be taken care of. Susie referred to him as an iceberg to one of her friends. However, nothing had really changed in their relationship since the beginning, except her feelings. He was content. He reasoned that because she loved to give, by receiving, he served her. Based on their past and her behavior with people in general, and with him in particular, there was no reason for him to think otherwise. But Susie's own desires were changing. She, the emotional vending machine, was now taking care of many more people than Warren alone. Recently, she had watched over Alice Buffett as she succumbed after a painful battle with cancer. Yet this time, Susie was developing a yearning to be taken care of herself. Thus, while her husband pursued his new businesses away from Omaha or sat sunk in thought in his office, Susie spent less and less time at home, going to lunch, to dinner, or to jazz clubs in the evening with friends, and traveling more widely. She now had a number of new friends much younger than she. They admired her and returned her generosity and tenderness with openly expressed feelings that ranged from warm-hearted affection to outright adoration. But they were less like adopted children and more like genuine friends, albeit friends who, like all her friends, needed her. At home, Susie had begun paying attention to Peter, her quiet son, in a different way, treating him too as a friend, confidant, and source of emotional support now that he was growing up and about to enter high school. Susie Jr. was living in Lincoln, having enrolled at the University of Nebraska. Howie, who had broken the family record for getting grounded, was in his junior year of high school, and Susie now devoted herself to launching him into college. She took him to debate meets and helped him corral his energy and burnish his high school record. Warren, as usual, was happy to delegate all these responsibilities to her. Susie did succeed in enticing Warren to really pitch in and get involved, rather than simply write checks, whenever business intersected with a cause to which he could lend his expertise. Her friend Rodney Weed and other leaders in the black community had gotten the idea of starting a minority-owned bank to enhance community pride and economic development on the North Side. Promoting black capitalism, they came to Buffett and his friend Nick Newman, the man who had sponsored Warren in local civil rights activities. Weed was a respected figure in Omaha, and Buffett liked banks. He had just joined the board of Omaha National Corporation, the biggest bank in town, a long-held ambition. He had an automatic and rational predisposition toward any business where people gave money to the business faster than the company dispersed it. So he was willing to listen to Weed, but wanted to know if a minority bank was viable. Since the hope was that Community Bank would attract a diverse group of customers, he hired Peter and one of his friends to sit outside another minority bank to count how many people went inside and to classify them by race. Peter's tally made Warren optimistic, so he joined an advisory board of directors for the Community Bank of Nebraska and also got John Harding from Ruane Cunniff on the board. Buffett told the founders that if they could raise $250,000 in stock from the black community, the advisory board would raise money to match it. The bank set up its office in a trailer. "You're really hitting bottom, Warren," said Joe Rosenfield. "When we're asking people to put their money into something, you can drive off in the middle of the night and take the whole bank with it." Most of the managers and the board of directors, which included Buffett's baseball player friend Bob Gibson, were black, and most were financial tenderfoots. To stave off disaster, Buffett went into his teaching mode and tried to educate the founders on the need for strong lending standards. The bank, he stressed, was not a charity or social services agency. He attended monthly board meetings that stretched late into the night, but as with the companies he owned, he was never involved in the day-to-day management. Harding, however, spent every day at the bank, making sure its numbers balanced. "The management from the community was well-intentioned," Harding says, "but not financially savvy." Asked for more money to cover bad loans, Buffett said no. Weed felt Buffett didn't understand the cycle of poverty and never understood his role as a wealthy man in our beleaguered community. But Buffett understood the numbers. He knew the bank wouldn't help anyone by relaxing its lending standards and making uncollectible loans, which would only teach the wrong financial lesson. So the bank limped along for years without growing. He got a chance to help in another way when Hallie Smith, a friend of Susie's, began to bring her the names of black kids who needed money because they couldn't pay for college. Susie started giving $1,000 here and there. "I've got to ask Warren," she said over and over. "Susie, you have money. Why don't you just pay for it?" Smith asked in amazement. "No, I can't," Susie always said. "It has to go through Warren." Smith found it incredible that someone as rich as Susie allowed her husband to make every decision involving money. Thus, while Susie was in charge of the family foundation, they worked together on funding and donations. She would have given away huge sums had Warren not put on the brakes. The foundation made small grants to education, and it didn't have professional management. To do a proper job of managing it required thinking forward. What was going to happen to all that money someday when it ended up in the foundation? Warren felt that someday was far away. Susie had a passionate desire to help in the here and now, but someone needed to strategize for the future. A year before, Warren had had what for many 40-year-olds would have been a wake-up call. During a dinner at the Sarnitz in California, one of his fingers started to swell. He had taken a double dose of delayed-action penicillin earlier that day for a minor infection. Bernie Sarnett, a surgeon, suspected an allergic reaction. He gave Warren antihistamines and advised him to get to a hospital. Buffett didn't want to go to the hospital. He had already had enough of sickness in 1971 after a recent bout of salmonella. "Besides," said Susie, "he was a bad patient and had a palpable horror of doctors and hospitals, sickness and medicine." He had Susie drive him back to the house they were renting for the summer. But as he continued ballooning and grew dizzy and sick, she began an urgent search for a doctor who could see Warren in a hurry. The one she finally reached insisted that they go to an emergency room immediately instead. By then, Buffett was barely conscious, and the emergency room team started working to save his life. 3 days later, he was still in the hospital. He was lucky, the doctors told him. His penicillin allergy was so severe that if he took it again, he would be dead. As he recovered, Roy and Martha Tolles tried to cheer him up by bringing him a copy of Playboy magazine, but he was too weak to hold it himself and had Susie turn the pages for him. Warren complained, however, that she flipped the pages too fast. Yet even after this encounter with his own mortality, back home in Omaha, he remained as fixated on business as ever. Retirement, in Buffett's special sense, meant no longer acting as a fiduciary. He would be investing as long as he was breathing. He could not help but be competitive, so much so that recently, when 6-year-old Jonathan Brand, son of his friends Henry and Roxanne Brand, had taken him on in chess, Warren couldn't bear it when it looked as though he was losing. As the game neared its conclusion, he began buffeting little Johnny until he won. By the time her husband had vanquished little Johnny Brandt, Susie had cultivated an attitude of ironic detachment about Warren's stubbornness. "Whatever Warren wants, Warren gets," was her way of describing the man who, as his little sister Bertie had observed all those years ago, always got his way. On a visit to Des Moines with a friend to hear the writer and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel speak at one of the local synagogues, Susie had spent hours talking to Milt Brown, who now lived there, at a dessert party at somebody's house. For some time, she had been filled with feelings of regret about that interrupted relationship. She now wondered openly to close friends whether it was too late to go down a different path. While she rarely talked about her problems or showed self-pity, she acknowledged being depressed about the state of her marriage. But despite her unhappiness, she made no move to address her issues directly or to leave. Rather, she rekindled her relationship with Milt. And increasingly, she seemed drawn to California. She had fallen in love with the place they had been renting at Emerald Bay in Laguna Beach, perched 50 feet above the ocean among a group of other luxury vacation homes. Warren particularly disliked buying houses, considering money spent on them as lying fallow, not earning its keep. Susie needled him about money. "If we were rich," she said, "you would just go up to that house and ask the owner how much she wants for it, and pay however much she asked. But I know we're not rich." In their perpetual tug of war, however, Susie was usually able to dislodge the cash from him in the end. Buffett eventually sent Roy Toll's wife, Martha, a canny bargainer, to negotiate for the house. She dickered the owner down to $150,000, and when Roy Tolles called to tell Warren, he said, "I have bad news. You bought it." Chapter 35. The Sun. Omaha, 1971 to 1973. Susie set to work decorating the place in Emerald Bay with casual rattan furniture. She installed a separate telephone line for Warren, who spent most of the time when he was in California watching business news on television and talking on the phone. The personal concerns and Joe Rosenfield were drawing her husband in the opposite direction from California, toward Washington and electoral politics. The Buffetts hosted a dinner in Omaha for Senator George McGovern, the 1972 Democratic candidate for president, and Warren had given money to Allard Lowenstein, a former congressman known as the Pied Piper of liberals, who resembled Gene McCarthy in his power to galvanize young people into activism over civil rights. He had also backed John Tunney, the Kennedy-esque son of heavyweight boxer Gene Tunney, in his successful Senate run in California. Tunney's golden boy political career became inspiration for the movie The Candidate, about a charismatic politician who is too young, too handsome, too liberal, too perfect to win, so can afford to tweak the establishment. The candidate was the kind of politician for whom Buffett consistently fell. Men with the ineffable magnetism of Hollywood stars, men whose presence stirred voters' emotions, except that he wanted his candidates to win. He had an idea that he thought would be helpful to politicians about what he called the discomfort index, the inflation rate plus the unemployment rate, which he passed on to Harold Hughes of Iowa, to whom Rosenfield had introduced him. Hughes had been a truck driver and a drunk. He was big physically, had a big voice, and was one of the most significant orators in decades. He looked a lot like Johnny Cash and had that kind of voice. He arose sort of from nowhere as a truck driver to become governor of Iowa and prominent in the Democratic Party. Joe was a good friend of his, and he had become a big force in the Senate. So we were helping him and gave modest amounts of money to a presidential exploratory effort. The war was his big issue. He was very anti-Vietnam, very eloquent. A college dropout, messianic Christian, and reformed alcoholic who was sometimes described as the Iowa populist, Hughes would skip a scheduled meeting at the drop of an empty vodka bottle to help someone with a drinking problem through a crisis. Several times he had successfully saved colleagues from suicide, and once, to his deep regret, he had failed. With a magnetic personality, he was considered both a dark horse and a rising star, the kind of candidate who would attract the young, the blue-collar voters, and the insurgent liberals who had voted for McCarthy. In other words, he was the great hope for a populist resurgence among a field of uninspiring candidates. At the time, no other Democratic candidate was attracting significant support. McGovern, the leader of the pack, was getting only 5 points in national opinion polls. In the spring of 1971, Hughes summoned 6 of his closest advisors and aides, including Buffett and Joe Rosenfield, and directed them to present every possible argument why he should or should not seek the nomination. At the end of May 1971, we had this meeting in a hotel in Washington. They were ready to go ahead on a big scale, although it was one of those meetings where it's already predetermined what you're going to do, but you have to hold it to get organized and feel good, rally the troops. About a month before this meeting, Hughes had been on Meet the Press. At the very end of the show, Larry Spivak said, "Senator, there has been some talk about your interest in extrasensory perception and the occult. Would you clarify your beliefs on this?" Hughes had just started to answer, and then the program got cut off. So when the Washington meeting was just about done, I said, "Senator, I watched that program about a week ago. If you ever get asked a question like that again, I would suggest that initially, before you even answer, point out to the questioner that there's a significant difference between ESP and the occult. Don't let the questioner, by linking those two things, nail you, so that by answering, 6 months from now, they'll say you talked about the occult when you were really talking about ESP." The floodgates opened. Hughes said, "10 years ago, I woke up in a bathtub in a fine hotel. I didn't know where I was, didn't know where my family was. I didn't know how I'd gotten there, and I was of no use to anybody. Then on this earth, at that moment, I became aware, and that's what made me want to feed the hungry." Then he said, "That experience came from visions that I have." He went on, "I believe in precognition. My daughter had a vision of the spots on these kittens before they were born, and she described them to me. And they were born that way. And somebody else had seen a remote vision of a fire that was happening." I said, "Now, Senator, if I'm Larry Spivak, the next question I'm going to ask you is this. If your daughter tells you she has a vision of Soviets preparing to launch ICBM missiles at the United States, are you going to order a preemptive strike against the Soviet Union?" And he said, "I would have to give that serious consideration." I said, "Now, Senator, I'm Larry Spivak, and you're sitting there at that table, and you've got that glass of water in front of you, and I say, do you believe somebody can make that glass of water move across the desk through the powers of their mind, standing some feet away?" And he said, "Yes, I believe that can be done." There were these people around the room, some of them who had their whole careers invested in the guy, like his chief of staff, and they saw themselves in the White House. And they started denying what they were hearing. They were waving their hands and saying it didn't mean what it meant. As I kept going, they were just dying. They were bursting in and saying, "That isn't what he's saying, and don't worry about this, it can be taken care of," and that Abraham Lincoln had believed some of the same things. Obviously, they knew some of this already. The whole thing was going down the tubes. I have never seen anything like it. It was just fascinating because of the years of preparation and these guys who had been dreaming of working for a U.S. president. Finally, at one point, Joe said, "Senator, tell Warren if he asks another question like that, you're going to make him disappear." So I said, "Senator, look it. There are all kinds of phonies in American politics. You know, they profess to believe in God, and they say they go to church every Sunday and everything. They don't believe a damn word of it, you know. But it works. You, on the other hand, believe something very sincerely, and you've got your reasons for it, you know. But I will promise you that there's 10% of the normal Democratic vote, or some significant percentage of the votes that you can't have just because of something you honestly believe, whereas the other guy is getting the vote because of something he doesn't believe. That's just a reality. Meanwhile, all these guys are saying, don't pay any attention, what does he know? But Hugh said that he would go away, and when he came back, he would do something that would end his candidacy. And so it came to pass that 10 days later, Hughes gave an interview to the Des Moines Register in which he said that he had recently spent an hour talking to his dead brother through a medium. Thus ended the presidential ambitions of Senator Harold Hughes. The episode with Harold Hughes would prove to be the peak, the nadir, and, thanks in part to Richard Nixon's eventual reelection, for many years the end of Buffett as would-be kingmaker. But throughout it, Buffett paid careful attention to the overwhelming influence of media in politics. He wanted some of that. A childhood throwing newspapers, his friendship with Fortune reporter Carol Loomis, the purchase of the Sun, a search for other newspapers to buy, and his investment in the Washington Monthly, Buffett's interest in publishing had grown and compounded. He had seen the overwhelming power of television to capture attention throughout the tumultuous 1960s, from the JFK assassination to the Vietnam War to the civil rights movement. Now, as the profitability of television became apparent, he wanted a piece of that business, too. Then Bill Ruane set him up at a dinner in New York with an acquaintance, Tom Murphy, who ran Capital Cities Communications, a company that owned broadcasting stations. Murphy, the son of a Brooklyn judge, had grown up in the spicy chowder of New York politics before joining the Harvard Business School, class of 49. Jowly, balding, easygoing, Murphy had started by managing a bankrupt TV station in Albany so frugally that he painted only the sides of the building that faced the road. Then he started to buy broadcasters, cable companies, and publishers, creating a media empire. Before long, he moved to New York and recruited another HBS classmate, Dan Burke, brother of Johnson & Johnson CEO Jim Burke. After their dinner, Murphy strategized with Ruane about how to get Buffett on his board of directors. Ruane said the way to Buffett's heart was to visit him in Omaha. Murphy promptly made the pilgrimage. Buffett plied him with a steak dinner, then drove him home to meet Susie. She must have known by now what to expect. Her husband had met another new object of infatuation. Buffett liked to show new people his totems, the office, Susie, and sometimes the train set. After the tour, he and Murphy played a couple of games of racquetball in the Buffett's basement court, Murphy running around in his Oxford dress shoes. Buffett saw where he was headed before Murphy could pop the question. "You know, Tom," he said, "I couldn't become a director because I'd have to have a major position in your company, and your stock is too high." Even though the rest of the market was stumbling downhill, investors were excited about television stocks. Cable television was new, and local franchises were consolidating into newly visible public companies, whipping up investors' excitement about the medium. "Look it," he said, "you can have me for nothing. You don't need me on the board." So Murphy started calling Buffett every time he made a deal. Buffett, just over 40, was flattered and made unlimited time for Murphy, then in his mid to late 40s, even though he thought, "This guy is old." But he understands the whole world, and "I was in awe of Murph," Buffett says. "I thought he was the ultimate businessman." One evening, Murphy phoned him at home and offered him first shot at a Fort Worth TV station that was for sale. Buffett was interested, but for reasons he doesn't recall, turned Murphy down, which he later called one of his greater business mistakes. What Buffett really wanted was to be a publisher. In fact, he thought he had a hot scoop, but when he gave the editors at the Washington Monthly the idea, they pooh-poohed it. "I'm just sure in my heart," says Charles Peters, the Monthly's publisher, "that the editors were offended at the idea of having an investor call them up and tell them to do a story. They told Peters it was no real story for the Monthly, and Peters did not push back. Then Buffett turned to the Omaha Sun, which might not have a national platform, but was better than no newspaper at all. As matters turned out, says Peters, I could have shot everybody on my staff. What Buffett had heard was that Boys Town, one of Omaha's sacred cows, had turned into a hog. A refuge for homeless boys, Boys Town was founded in an old mansion near downtown in 1917 by Father Edward Flanagan, an Irish priest who wanted to save orphans and rejected children from wasted lives as drifters, criminals, or addicts.